The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Please join me in welcoming Jose Garces and April White.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. Jose, I want to get started right at the beginning.
You got it.
Being a chef is a lifelong process. I learned this from my time writing this book with Jose. So you write in Latin Evolution that food was an important part of your childhood in Chicago, where your parents immigrated from Ecuador just a few years before you were born. Did you know from a young age that you were going to be a chef?
Actually, from a young age, I didn't know what a chef was, or who, you know, that there were actually chefs existed, and that it was a glorified profession that it has become now. All I knew is that I enjoyed eating, and my mom, Magdalena, and my grandma, Mamita Mada, who's here, they're here in the audience today, were huge influences, and I just knew that at some point I would aspire somehow in the cooking field, but that's really it.
I know that you had a chance to sort of have your first cooking lessons in your mother's kitchen. Can you tell me about how your life sort of revolved around the kitchen when you were a child?
Certainly. My mom, being a working mom, she would come home about usually around 4:30, and she would start the cooking process. And it's then when I really started to, you know, really learn about flavor. And one of the things that she taught me early on was really, she was developing my palate from an early age in terms of just knowing about flavor, salt, acidity, herbs, just, you know, unbeknownst to me, my palate was being tested every day. Taste this. What do you think of this? How do you feel about that? And it's really, that's really was the core of my inspiration.
Take me back to some of those meals. What were the type of things that that you would eat in your household?
One of the things, your traditional Ecuadorian style recipes, empanadas, arepas. I mean, even to this day, my mom is still a huge part of our lives. But we make arepas now. They're white corn cakes filled with cheese. We make them for my kids at home. So just having those flavors and those smells in our house were such a big part of what this book is all about as well.
Okay. Now, when you headed off to cooking school, you actually sought out a classic French education, and a lot of your first jobs were in non-Latin restaurants. Did you? What brought you back to Latin food after that?
Well, going to cooking school at the time was, and Julie can attest to this, you had a term for guys or people that really didn't know what they wanted to do but ended up going to cooking school. What was that term? It was pretty, you told me at dinner today. It was like a term for a person who didn't really know, didn't really have a path. And I'm sure you'll remember it. But you know, when I went to undergrad, I had been in undergrad for a couple of years, and I really wasn't inspired, or didn't feel like I had a true direction. And it was then when I looked to cooking school, and they were teaching French classical cuisine, and it really was kind of a way to be important or be special. You know, I was still kind of shunning my Latin roots and heritage by learning this French classical cuisine. I didn't think I was, you know, Latin food was really that important or that evolved at the time. So it wasn't until after some periods of cooking in New York City where I really started to figure out, gosh, you know, if I'm going to do this for the long run, I really need to do some cooking that's going to be important to me. So I reverted back to Latin cooking, and that's where it went.
Okay. One of the things you told me during the cookbook process and wrote in the cookbook is that you never imagined that these foods that you grew up with would become so well-known and so well-regarded. Why do you think that Latin cooking did sort of take that step into big, important cooking? And do you think it's a trend that's here to stay?
I think Latin cooking is really, it's just really about flavor. And one of the things we talk about in the book is really the foods of Spain, South America, Mexico. And when you, there's just so much to grab from those different areas. And there's just so much flavor that's involved with, when you talk about all those different countries. It's definitely here to stay. It's a hot trend. I'm hoping to keep it evolved and going forward.
That actually leads to my next question. And throughout the cookbook and throughout your restaurants, when you talk about Latin foods, you're not only talking about Latin America, you're not only talking about your parents' native Ecuador, you're talking about South America and the Caribbean and Latin America and Mexico and Spain. What is it that connects all of those cuisines for you?
Well, I think that one of the things I speak of in the book is the fact that Spain occupied so many of these areas for so many hundreds of years that they kind of, the Spanish were able to tie all of them together, not necessarily through ingredients, but just a mesh of European culture plus indigenous, whether it be natives, whether it was the Mayans in Mexico or the Incas in Peru. They were able to somehow mesh those cultures together. And that's really, you know, really the, again, the true inspiration for me was really looking at these different cultures and figuring out ways in which I could innovate, innovate their traditional concepts.
Mm-hmm. And how would you describe your approach to cooking? How do you create a new dish, and what do you think about when you're doing that?
Research is one of the most important things. And for all my restaurants and all the different concepts, I typically travel either to whichever region we're going to. So really looking at authentic recipes and creating new and innovative ones is how I look at it. And basically, for instance, we're doing a Asian and Latin concept coming up here in January. Specifically, we looked at Chifas, which are Chinese restaurants in Peru. And 100 years ago, there was a huge Chinese movement, immigration movement to Peru. So we went to Peru in the hopes of finding this magical fusion of Peruvian and Chinese food. But what we end up finding is that they're just Chinese restaurants that happen to be in Peru. So we didn't find the fusion. But yet, when I was in Peru, I saw these great markets. I saw the incredible ingredients and the way in which they prepare their foods. So taking a look at those cultures through cuisine is how I start the process. Once I have the research and data and I have all that kind of figured out, I look at my local ingredients, local products, and modern techniques. So we take the standard recipes and incorporate the local ingredients and modern techniques. And then currently we start looking at textures, flavors, colors on the plate. That's the whole artistic element of cooking. So using the backdrop of research and incorporating some artistic and creative elements is how we come up with our latest dishes.
Can you think of an example from the cookbook or from one of your restaurants that sort of really incorporates those ideas for you?
Sure. A perfect example is our gazpacho recipe in the book. Gazpacho in Spain is typically very thin, and it's almost drunken out of a glass.
Okay.
When I first started encountering gazpachos here in the U.S., they were chunky, tomato-like salsa, mm-hmm. like soups, which were just misinterpreted. So what I took was how I learned how to make a gazpacho in Spain, which was the actual drink. And then we incorporated some of the more modern techniques, like in our book we use a cucumber jelly just to give it a little freshness, a little more texture, and just dried tomato chips, which float right on top. So just adding like the finishing touches to a traditional dish is how I would approach it.
Okay, great. Now, one of the things you mentioned was the artistic component. And I know in the book we talk about putting it all together, or about plating, which is a word most people didn't know before Top Chef.
Sure.
Why is plating important in restaurants and even to the home chef? Why is that a big element for you?
Well, plating in general, I mean, most folks eat with their eyes. So in a couple of regards, it's very important. Nowadays, perceived value or perception is huge. So when you plate in our restaurants, we try to make sure that the perceived value, I mean, it's a little bit of a secret, but we want to make sure that folks think that they're getting a good value for what they're paying for. And then just the artistry portion of it is so important, and it's so much fun, honestly. It's really what it's all about for me in the development and creative process. So plating foods continues to evolve, and there is a certain art form to it, mm-hmm. for sure.
It seems like you had a lot of fun with the book in the photo shoot, kind of putting things together.
Yeah, I mean, when we first started playing, we thought there was going to be a food stylist that was going to plate the mm-hmm. food. And after about the first 30 seconds of them plating, I just couldn't allow that for my first work. So I just basically took the project on of plating all of the dishes, and there's a lot of tricks in plating food photography, but we did the best we could, and we feel like the end product was pretty good.
Excellent. Now, one of the other things that you seem to hold important in your cooking is the idea of smaller portions. Now, not just the tapas idea that you have at Amada, but the idea that, you know, it doesn't have to be an enormous portion of meat in the middle of the plate. Why do you think that's important?
Well, smaller portions are, you know, for a few decades there in the 80s and even 90s, I mean, this is kind of my generation, but restaurants were serving huge portions of protein, center of the plate. Everything was just tremendous. And I think that serving smaller portions nowadays and giving people variety in what they're choosing is very important, and that less is sometimes more really applies. Mm-hmm. And as long as the quality is there and perceived value, then you'll be in pretty good shape. But the small plate phenomena that's happened over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, I feel should continue to grow and will be a trend to continue.
Now, in the book, you mention that the business plan for Amada is strikingly similar to one that you put together back in culinary school. So you always knew you were headed in this direction. But for a lot of chefs, it's very difficult to make the jump from chef to restaurant owner. Talk a little bit about how you go about creating a restaurant as opposed to being the guy in the kitchen.
Sure. In a lot of respects, it's very much the same. You do your research, i.e., you know, you look for the location, you check the demographics, you would gather your mise en place or your ingredients. In this case, becomes the personnel and human resources, and then you execute, and you set out to do it. So I treated it a lot like creating a dish, and consistency and hospitality is one of those things that is also very important when you're creating dishes for restaurant goers. So just, you know, being consistent and, gosh, you know, communicating, I think, is really another big piece from being a chef and just creating a dish to being a restaurateur, is your communication skills need to be on a super high level with all of your employees, vendors. It's a huge part of it.
And we talked about during the process of writing the book about how, in addition to the things that you learned from other chefs that you worked with in the kitchen, that it was particularly, I believe, your experiences in Spain that sort of taught you this idea of hospitality and how important that particular element could be. What did you see in these restaurants that made that sort of click with you?
Well, when I cooked in Spain, and that was in 96, I was fortunate enough to be in Marbella, and the restaurant where I was in a town called Puerto Banús, which was owned by a priest. And I just saw, the priest actually owned three restaurants, La Taberna. But he was a very gracious, humble man who really, that was the one piece of his restaurant world which he would not let go by, which was the hospitality. That you come into his house, it was like being in his living room, and that it's just a big part of a successful business model. So one of the things that I told my staff when we opened Amato was I took his words and said, if the customers that come into through our doors, it's just like they would be in your living room. And I continue to hold that philosophy very, very strongly, and especially during these times, it's of the utmost importance to be very hospitable and gracious and give good service.
Great. Now, for many chefs, the ultimate goal is New York, New York, New York, New York. And you spent some time cooking in New York, but you landed here and you've stayed here for the most part, which we'll get to in a minute. What brought you to Philly and what encouraged you to stay?
Well, actually, I got sick of New York. New York is a great town. I mean, I took my chops there. I line cooked there for 5 years. One of the restaurants I worked at was called the Rainbow Room, and I remember one night we did 1,000 covers, and I cooked sauté that night, and I remember changing my clothes twice because I had sweat rings all the way up and down. So I felt like I did it in New York. I got it. I worked my butt off and learned how to cook. And a part of me said, I need a change. And a good friend, mentor of mine, Douglas Rodriguez, was opening Alma de Cuba here in Philadelphia with Steven Starr. And it was just the perfect match for me to come to a really nice town, which, when I got to Philadelphia, I was just so impressed with the town and quality of life compared to New York, quite honestly. I mean, I really enjoyed living a block off Rittenhouse Square versus somewhere in Queens way off it. So that was a huge attraction, and I've had a love affair with the city since I got here. Mm-hmm.
What made this, you've definitely been part over the years of, I won't use the term restaurant renaissance because it's overused and already copyrighted in this town, but in terms of the growth of big successful restaurants we've had in the past couple of years, you've definitely been a part of it. What made you decide that this was fertile ground for your first restaurant?
Well, being with Steve Starr for about 5 years, and I kind of saw him grow his empire. He grew from 2 restaurants to 13, and that's nowhere near where I want to be, quite honestly. But being in the restaurants, I opened Alma de Cuba and was the chef of Alves. I just noticed a certain amount of loyalty that our customers had. Mm-hmm. If they enjoyed themselves, they would come back repeatedly. And I hadn't felt that in New York, and I hadn't felt that in Chicago when I was there earlier in my career. So that loyalty is really what's driven me to stay and be here in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Now, every chef is scared when they're opening their first restaurant. But when you were opening Amata, did you know that you wanted to own more than one restaurant? Did you know that you wanted to keep going?
No, I really wanted to just do Amata and just have fun with it. And, I was terrified to death. I basically... mortgaged everything I had, put my bank took the right arm and just said, if you mess up, we're taking that. So I
hard to cook that way.
So I was just petrified. I worked scared for 2 or 3 years. And luckily, after we had seen some success at Amada, I had felt that I had more to give, and under the right circumstances, I could do so.
Now that you own 4 restaurants, 3 here in Philly and 1 in Chicago, can we ever find you in the kitchen, or does chef mean something different now?
Chef means something a little different to me now. I mean, at this point, I'm 36, but I've been cooking for almost 15 years. So for me, it's more mentoring and working with the chefs that are in each restaurant. Mm-hmm. We sit down and we go through the development, because that's really where I get my kicks, is developing menus. And watching them develop as well as chefs, and hopefully, after putting some tenure with our company, going off and doing it themselves. So that's really where I get my enjoyment. And just I think at some point a 20 or 30 seater that I'm just in, this is down the road, will be.
So not next year?
No, not next year.
You took what I think is probably a pretty big step for a chef and opened in another city. How's that experience been for you?
That's been great, because it was a type of homecoming for me. I was born and raised in Chicago and spent the first 22 years of my life there, had many friends and family there. So it was a great experience. I partnered with another group, Sage Restaurant Group, and we opened in a historic hotel, a Blackstone Hotel. And Chicago hadn't seen tapas the way we were doing it here at Amada or in Philadelphia. So needless to say, for the last 6 months or 8 months since we've opened, it's been a really nice success story. So I feel like it's been such a whirlwind year, and Mercat actually received an Esquire magazine recognition for one of the best new restaurants in America in 2008. So, yeah, it's been a great year. Thank you.
So we have Spanish tapas at Amada, and we have Basque Country tapas at Tinto, and Mexican at Distrito. What's next for you?
Well, there's a couple things. And, it's just lately, it's just the creativity has been flowing. But next, immediately, we're going to do a Asian Latin concept, and specifically Peruvian and Chinese, as we spoke of. It's called Chifa, and it's going to be located at 707 Chestnut Street. We're due to open and towards the end of January, I would think would be safe. And that is going to be where I hang my hat for a while, especially in the ceviche bar. I'm expecting to really do some incredible, fun, amazing things with ceviche. I want to kind of bring it to the next level, next step. Outside of that, we're working on a whiskey bar. And I'm coming full circle, and what I feel like coming back to, like, lately I've been feeling more American, or more of like the American culinary scene. So we're developing a whiskey bar that has all single barrel distilled whiskeys from the U.S., American bar snacks, a delicious burger, and that's going to be on the corner of Tinto. And I guess the second part of that, so that's a bar. And the second part of that is going to be called Village Food, which is like a slow food movement, local, organic, healthy, American bistro. And that's down the road, but it's like in the pipeline. You know, we're just starting to develop it already.
That's great. All that, and you decided to write a cookbook, too. Writing a cookbook, I'm sure, exercises a very different muscle than cooking or developing restaurants. What was it that gave you sort of the ambition to write a cookbook?
really just the last, you know, as I said earlier, I'd been cooking for 15 years, and we had developed so many recipes, probably over 2,000 recipes. And I just wanted to, you know, pluck some of the ones that I really felt were good and start to really move forward Latin cuisine. I think it had become stale in the last couple of years. Nobody had really done anything new or exciting. Bring it to the forefront and set up a stage to continue it moving forward and just continue to educate on the different cultures, Spanish, Mexican, and South American.
Aside from my nagging questions throughout the process, what was the hardest part for a chef putting together a cookbook?
Your nagging questions.
I admit to it.
Your nagging questions. the hardest part was, I think, you know, like we had spoken of earlier, what a learning process it was to just write a cookbook from start to finish. And we had some pretty aggressive timelines along the way, which we did our best to hit. Mm-hmm. And I think just the whole process, even up until now, you know, it has really been a really great experience for us. And I think I look forward to doing a few more maybe. We'll see how it goes.
Between the restaurants and the cookbook and the Iron Chef appearance, that was referenced earlier, you've sort of really catapulted yourself into that celebrity chef realm. How do you feel about the term, and how do you like the experience of that?
I find it very flattering and not... I don't consider myself a celebrity. I consider someone who goes to work, has a lot of employees to make sure that that they're doing well, and I have a wife and two children who I have to attend to on a regular basis and set some time aside for. And so the celebrity status is neither here nor there. I feel like I just want to continue to do, and if it comes, then it comes.
Do you think that this is a necessary part of being a chef these days, to not just be in your kitchen cooking, but also to be sort of pursuing your diner in all kinds of other ways?
I think that it's definitely something that's evolved in the last decade, and you need to continue to market yourself and continue to market the restaurant's product. It's ongoing, and it engulfs a large part of my day. Finding business, you know, doing whatever you can to reach out. And it's the restaurant business is a lot different, I think, than it was even 10 years ago.
When you sat down to write the cookbook, were there certain lessons or philosophies of cooking that you were hoping that people would take away from the book?
Yeah, I would say that on two different levels. For the home cook, I wanted them to be able to look at new cultures and new cuisines and open their minds to those different cultures, as well as exploring new techniques, new methods, and also basically show that you can find these different ingredients, exotic ingredients, via the internet, via some local markets, and use them. And we also tapped this book for the ambitious, or actually for the young professional. And for the young professional, it was meant to really inspire, open up their minds to, once again, Latin cuisine, and hopefully come and work for me.
You've had, as you told me, some great mentors through the process of your own learning experience. And it seems that in Philadelphia, there is a pretty good community of chefs who can collaborate or bounce ideas off of each other, or just promote each other through having great restaurants. Does that play a big role in your cooking life?
Yeah. I mean, the Philadelphia culinary scene has boomed in the last 10 years, and there are some great chefs. Mark Vetri is a good friend of mine, and we speak as peers, as colleagues, and as just cooks sometimes. And it's really helpful when you have someone who's at the top of his game and, you know, you're both just really doing. We had actually, in regards to your last question, drumming up and marketing yourselves, we were both talking about creating a catering kitchen or making our own breads or getting these facilities to make our own charcuterie. And it's so funny that we were just, you know, so sunk in. We both were, like, thinking about the exact same thing. And then we stopped and said, oh, maybe we could share a space or figure out ways in which we could do it efficiently.
That's great. Okay, so from the sounds of it, you probably work about 25 hours a day. But what are you cooking when you're not working, or where are you eating when you're not working?
My wife and my mom both are at home regularly, and they're great. My wife's Cuban. She does great Cuban food, and my mom does Ecuadorian food. So my best meals are at home with them.
Nice. Do they make you do the dishes?
Sometimes. I think I had to do them yesterday, yeah.
We actually collaborated additionally on a piece in Food and Wine recently about Thanksgiving. Did you end up cooking your own Thanksgiving this year?
Well, I didn't this year. We're on a rotation system between two other couples, so I had the year off. And my wife kept telling me, because we had a large group, she was like, well, we really should do it at our house. And I said, maybe not. So I was happy to have the year off, but next year it's my year, and I welcome it. I love it.
For this particular feature in Food and Wine, Jose cooked Thanksgiving in June, maybe?
Yes.
I think it was
We
June.
Cooked it in June. And
two or three times in June.
We staged our home and did a... It was quite a production, but...
Great. Well, I can open the floor up to any questions. Is there any questions out there?
Well, that's a good question, because globalization has really taken over, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years, where you could get, you know, asparagus or fava beans year-round. And especially in the last 5 years, the demand for such foods has grown so much that you could basically get, you know, get anything you want from anywhere at any point. Is that the right move? I mean, it's great for diners, or it's great, but locally and environmentally, and it's just not. It's probably not a good move. So eventually, I feel like we're going to shift into this slow food movement, local, and the chefs are going to have to adapt to that. I mean, that makes it harder for someone like me who has a Spanish concept or a Peruvian concept. You know, so it's kind of a catch-22.
Does the average chef, or you particularly, do you read reviews, and do they mean much to you? Particularly if you get a negative one, does it affect the way you cook that dish in the future?
I feel like the reviews have taken on a new face. You know, before, always and still now, you know, the main town food critic, whether it's Frank Bruni in New York or Craig Lebon here in Philadelphia, their review holds a lot of weight. I feel like some restaurant goers don't go to the new restaurants until the local reviewer has signed off on it and said, all right, it's good, go ahead. But the internet has really changed the face of real-time reviews through blogs, through internet food sites. You could basically go on anywhere on the web and find out how the place is without waiting for the main food critic. But it is, and they all hold a lot of weight. I'll go on there and see, because sometimes I might not catch something, and the customer is right.
Everybody up here in the front?
Thank you. When you appeared on Iron Chef, what was the main ingredient they offered, and how did you approach your strategy for the courses you developed?
Okay. Without getting myself in trouble with the show, we based a strategy on different types of ingredients that it could be, whether it was a vegetable, a fish, or meat. And our ingredient was melon. They had different types of melon, watermelon, honeydew, Asian melon. But we had a strategy based on if it's a fruit, we're going to go in this direction. And we practiced diligently for a couple weeks prior to the show just to make sure, because honestly, you can't put a menu together in a couple minutes. But it still was quite a challenge and just a totally thrilling experience. And I competed against Bobby Flay. He was very, very gracious, but I'm glad we won. And I'm glad we brought a I'm glad we brought a win to Philadelphia. We're the other than Chef Morimoto, we're the first chef team to win and compete. Thanks.
The woman in the middle here.
Congratulations on your incredible success. I'm wondering if along the way you've had any hiccups, errors, mistakes, disasters that you've learned an important lesson from, and if so, if you could share that with us.
Sure. Those have mainly been like business hiccups where I think that there's a lot of sharks out there in the water, you know? And I think sometimes naivety takes hold when you have this great idea and you just kind of want to go for it. So one of the things that I've learned is just be careful in real estate negotiations and lease negotiations and really just do your diligence, take your time, make sure that that the business model works and then progress forward. Don't go over on your construction project. Just those types of really, you know, really the ins and outs of the business is really where I felt I went in with just as being a chef and end up being a real estate valuer and just picked up a lot of trades along the way.
What is your experience and your interest in charcuterie, and how do you find that applicable to Latin cuisine?
Well, charcuterie is a big part of what we do at Amada and at Tinto as well. It's, you know, air curing meats and sausages and making sausages. And it's really hard to do those things in Philadelphia. You need a whole program. You need a huge setup to really make it work. We're working on establishing our own charcuterie, building a room and making our own. So it's really it's a big part of what we do, and I hope to continue to progress it forward.
Over here in the front. Does that work now?
Hi. My sister and I are both born in Lima, Peru, and we were wondering, when you were in Peru, did you just go to Chifa restaurants and casual restaurants in Peru, in Lima? Or did you go to like places like the famous, world famous Astrid and Gaston, like the higher end
yes.
places?
Yes. We did a 9-day culinary tour, and we went to two Chifas, and they were on throughout our, and we decided that that was enough. We got it. And we went to Lamar, which is Gaston Acurio's restaurant. He's a very Gaston Acurio's a Peruvian gentleman who owns several restaurants and many concepts. But yes, we were in Lima for 4 days, Cusco for 3 days. We went to Machu Picchu for a day, and throughout the process, we ate. Yeah, and I'm trying to think who else. What other Miguel? He has two restaurants in Lima. I forget his last name. But we went to Astrid and Gaston and really found that Lima was very cosmopolitan and also just on a world culinary stage, very, very well advanced at this point.
Yeah. Just describe how you would handle a difficult client, a patron who comes in and you serve a very fine meal and they have nothing but complaints. Mm. How do you handle that?
Kill them with kindness. you can't make everyone happy, but you know those folks everyone has their own way how they like things, but we certainly don't try to make the situation worse. You know, we will do whatever it takes. And one of my training grounds was the Four Seasons Hotel in New York, and one of their philosophies was, you know, whatever the customer wanted at any time. So if at 7 o'clock on a busy Saturday night they wanted Eggs Benedict, we would go and make Eggs Benedict for our customers. So customer comes first is not just a saying. It's a way of life, and that's kind of how we approach our business.
Right over here.
Thank you. The question I have for you, for your upcoming health food restaurant or a restaurant that has healthy cooking,
mm-hmm.
how are you going to be different from other health food restaurants or whatever in the city?
I think flavor is very important, and I go back to that. It's healthy food doesn't have to be bland or not, you know, not good. Really. Reduce sauces, reduce natural vegetable juices, and really try to accentuate seasonal ingredients. Bring them to the forefront and let the ingredients speak for themselves. That's one of my philosophies in any of the restaurants, is a good ingredient doesn't really need to be adulterated that much. It should speak for itself. Sure. We always have a backup plan for those people that are gluten intolerant and have different vegan needs. We would be prepared for those different requests and possibly, I mean, there's a whole concept waiting to happen right there. Dietary restaurants.
Down here in the front?
Yeah. Personally, I've eaten at all three of your restaurants, and equally wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm a hotel concierge, and sometimes I find it a little difficult for a particular segment, corporate businessmen, to sell them on the concept of small plates.
Sure.
Do you have that problem at all?
Well, I have the answer for those folks, because I have a 25-ounce steak on my menu at all the restaurants to make sure we take care of those guys, too.
Okay, good. Thank you. So you knew what I...
Yes.
Down here in the front?
Jose, this was awarded a prize as being one of the most influential Latinos in the Philadelphia area by our newspaper, Impactful Latin Newspaper. Do you feel like right now you're in a position of power that you can influence Latino chefs in the area? And what plans, what are you doing right now in order for you to help other Latino chefs in the Latino community?
Okay. That's a good question, because one of my mentors was, as I've said in the book and said in the past, was Douglas Rodriguez. And he, at the time... when I first encountered him in 1999 in New York, was one of these Latin chefs that was bringing, you know, Nuevo Latino or Latin food to the forefront. And what he did was his whole team of chefs were all Latin American kids who were all very talented, but he recruited these Latin American chefs and taught him his way, taught him everything he knew and gave him so many tools to be successful. So my goal would be to encourage any Latin chefs to come and see me and come and be a part of what we're doing. And our doors are always open to those folks. And, that's it. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Over here.
Sorry for too many questions, but what is I ate at Distrito, and I found that the chef tasting was relatively affordable, mm-hmm. as opposed to many other restaurants out there that are quote unquote chic and you know pricey. So why did you opt to a cheaper menu, at least on price?
I think that one of the things we looked at was being in the area, being in University City, we wanted to offer value. Also, there's this perceived value of Mexican cuisine, which sometimes correct and sometimes it's incorrect. In our case, I would say it would be incorrect, but more or less a welcome gesture, and not that I'm going to raise the price on the tasting menu, but a welcome gesture to the neighborhood to really give a great meal with good value, and that would be it.
Okay. Talked about local ingredients. Was it slow food, you said, mm-hmm. or slow? What do you mean by that? I've not
slow,
heard that expression.
Slow food is more of a local movement. And April, you may want to speak to that a little bit.
Sure. Slow food is a movement that got started in Italy, and it's basically the idea of bringing your attention back to food. It's handmade artisanal products, the best ingredients you can find. And recently there was a quite successful conference held out in San Francisco promoting the U.S. slow food movement. They did things like building a victory garden in front of San Francisco City Hall, talking to cheesemakers, farmers, all the people that sort of bring you back to the essence of what food is.
That's
right
it.
Over here, the one with the microphone.
Yes.
Since your earliest influence was Ecuadorian food, mm-hmm. does that cuisine show itself in your restaurants now? And if it doesn't, why would you not open an Ecuadorian restaurant?
Good question. I think that Chifa, which is, as I said, inspired by Peru and China, but not limited to those two areas. We're letting most of South America in and some of Southeastern Asia in as well in terms of using inspiration. So you will find some Ecuadorian dishes on the new Chifa menu. I've been waiting for the right concept. But on its own, it might be tough right now that, like, you know, to have an Ecuadorian-only restaurant that's not in a small neighborhood in terms of a big theme restaurant. But at some point, I'm working on my mom's recipes. I've been asking her to write one recipe a day. So maybe at some point.
Here in the middle.
Thank you. Thank you.
When you talk about, first of all, I think buying local is very important. And also, but in addition to that, where do you go for your food? Where do you purchase them? Do you purchase
them? Typically, you know, we have restaurant vendors because they come in a early morning hours, and they're used to doing the buying. The chefs at each restaurant do all of the purchasing, food purchasing. And if we can get local things, like whether it's through Reading Terminal Market or other, during the summer, the farmers markets, we'll go to that route. Otherwise, you know, we're getting our fish and a lot of our produce from the food supply houses, which are down on Oregon Avenue. So it's kind of a mixture of both. And as, like, local foods become more prevalent and easier to get, because right now there's kind of a disconnect between the farmers and the restaurants. So I think that there are a few agencies that are trying to put us together. And I think in the next couple of years we should see a lot more of that. I believe they do, yes. There's the Fair Food Project. Yeah.
The gentleman in the front?
In the interest of expanding the popularity of Latin cuisine, would you consider a pilot for a TV series? Would you consider television? I mean, the cookbooks, and I mean, it.
Yeah,
it
no,
seems
it's,
to be natural.
It's been a thought, and one of the things that I kind of struggle with, which is, do I want to be a celebrity? This thing came up, like, do I want to be a celebrity chef? Do I want to be on TV? Do I want to, you know, continue to write books, or do I want to continue to be with the food and be within the restaurants and be a huge influence and impact on that? And it's a balancing act that it, you know, I don't think many people have figured out yet. I think most, like, really talented chefs pick one direction or the other. So for now, I'm very happy to be with the food and creating concepts and continuing to develop our own concepts.
We have time for one more question if anyone has one. Over here, sir.
How you doing, Jeff?
Yeah.
What's your take on molecular gastronomy? Is there a place for it? And if so, is there a place for it in your type of restaurants?
I think that molecular gastronomy has definitely seen a lot of publicity over the last couple years. And what I try to do, my philosophy on it is I look at the methods and techniques and things that are applicable to the current market. I'll usually try to take, like, the espumas or the airs, certain things, but I still believe that real food is what sells, and molecular gastronomy tends to be a lot of science, and which I don't have any problem with, but I think at the end of the day, folks want to eat substantial or eat something that's wholesome.
I think that's a good place to end, and I want to thank Chef Jose Garces and April White for a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are books for sale upstairs, and I understand that Chef Garces will sign them if you wish. Okay, thank you very much, and
thank
we'll
you.
See you upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.